The next thing on this tape will be a song sung by Bernard Holmquist, a song that he had written, has written, called The Lord of Glory. Is that correct?
Or no. The Lord of Glory agonized in dark Gethsemane, and in his body bore my sin alone on Calvary. Upon the cross he bled and died, and paid sin's debt for me. Now cleansed by his redeeming blood, I've life eternally. His gift of righteousness is mine, I could not save myself, for he has sought me by his grace to own me for himself. The Savior God became my Lord, as in him I believed. Eternal life became my gift, as him I did receive. A child of God I am by faith. Oh, what a blessed thought! An heir of God, joint heir with Christ, this has salvation wrought. Eternal peace and endless joy, and life that is sublime. Great things ne'er seen, nor heard, nor thought, they are forever mine. Now Christ is risen from the grave, the first of them who died. So in my flesh I shall see God, and in his love abide. Soon Jesus Christ shall call his own to meet him in the sky. The dead in Christ shall come forth first, the rest shall never die. Transformed shall be my mortal self, his likeness my reward. Conformed unto the perfect man, the fullness of my Lord. The trumpet soon shall beckon me unto our holy tryst, and there forever I shall reign, the finished work of Christ.
Okay, what Swedish foods did you have at Christmas time? What did your mom do?
She'd prepare Swedish foods for weeks before Christmas, and we'd be feasting on Swedish food through New Year's. Of course, the big event was Christmas Eve. They'd make their own potatis carve. Mom and Dad would make get the sausage casings and mix it, and it was delicious. Nothing like, it's hard to find potatis carve that's good. Closest to it is Elsa Lindstrom. And Joan's mother, and Fresolta, and she'd have green corn, which was a barley and liver thing. She'd make a big bucket of that. And Uncle Joe, we didn't see him all year. He'd always show up. He always know when we had green corn. I don't know how he found out, but he'd always, because he loved it. And you put lingonberry sauce on that. I haven't had it since Mom passed away, and it was quite good. And you name it. And, it was a real smorgasbord, and she worked on it for a long, long time. That was in her younger years. When she was older, she didn't have the strength to do all that. Mm-hmm. And Dad would make inverstrinka in jars, and they'd drink that stuff. I never cared for it, but I'd drink a little bit just to
How was
for
it
the Christmas season, huh?
How was it made?
I don't know. Something you buy imports from Sweden, I think a root. And it's made with yeast. You have to be careful it doesn't ferment, because it can get powerful. Mm-hmm. One year, this happened when we lived in our apartment building. We were living on the first floor, it was three floors. And all of a sudden we heard popping going on in the basement. We went down there, and I guess a little bit too much heat in the basement, although the basement was relatively cool, and these things had fermented, and they were exploding out of the cans, out of the jars.
The corks were popping out?
No, they were regular.
Screw-on?
Screw-on, I think.
Oh.
And I went down with that. I didn't get too close to it, because that scared me. And I don't know if he saved any for Christmas, if he got some that had not, you know, fermented. I don't know. Can't remember. I didn't particularly care because I didn't like this stuff.
Yeah.
His mom did a lot of pastry baking, and she'd make all this Swedish pastry like you get in Danish pastry. And she was very good at that.
That was Swedish pastry.
Mm-hmm. She learned it from her mother, Beata Swanson, Betty Swanson, who was a very good cook, they tell me. But that was before my time.
Do you remember other foods you had? Glögg?
No, I've never had glögg.
No glögg.
No glögg. All kinds of fishes.
Hmm.
A lot of things you would import. Anchovies.
Sill?
Sill, of course, yeah. But otherwise, our day-by-day food was just plain casseroles and beef, lamb quite a bit. Soup, we like, she's good at making soup, and we like soup. Made delicious vegetable soups.
Hmm.
You realize that we were an affluent family and we lived well, and often we'd entertain the guests from the church, missionaries and dignitaries. But then Dad lost his business.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone else went broke too. Grandmother lost her savings, so she had to move home with us.
Beata?
Beata lived with us for a number of years. And Al was married and he was working, but they didn't pay him anything. Mm-hmm. They gave him IOUs, and he always kept working because no other job, so mm-hmm. might as well work and maybe get something.
Mm-hmm.
So
did
we
he
had,
ever get something for that?
I don't know. So we had six children, and Al's wife Hazel, and grandmother, that's eight, and mom and dad, that was 10. And dad had lost his business, so he was supporting 10 people. Now you can imagine the stress with Al and Russell, 2 years younger than two teenage girls, Eleanor and Laverne, and little Buddy. And little Buddy was, I guess they tried treating me all right, but I was a little kid and I was kind of in the way.
Mm-hmm. And Elaine was there too, no doubt.
And Elaine finally came. And she was a baby. It wasn't very, it was a lot of stress. I think I picked up a lot of stress. And, probably bothered me for years.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of got the idea nobody liked me because
yeah.
I was always in the way.
Yeah.
And I'd do something, one person scream at me from one end of the house, someone else after me from another end of the house. But I think it was probably just no one meant to do anything but squeeze all those people in one apartment, and you have to live on, be very careful on your budget. I remember one time we had $2 and mom sent me to the store to buy food. That's all we had. And I lost the $2.
Oh, no.
And so Laverne and I, they're very sympathetic. Laverne and I went out looking, and sure enough, there in the alley was my $2. And well, about two blocks away. I did all the shopping. I just bought all the shopping.
Why was that?
Well, mom was, everyone was busy doing something. Mom was busy keeping the house going and cleaning and cooking, and I knew prices. She'd ask me how much is a can of this, that, or the other thing.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't remember prices now, but maybe 7 cents for a can of beans, a dime for a loaf of bread. I could get milk at a Cut-Rate Dairy for 7 cents a quart. I remember that. We'd buy a soup bone for a quarter, and they'd leave quite a bit of meat on it. And get a bag of trimmings from produce like celery and cabbage and onions and things like that. A great big shopping bag for 10 cents. And that all go into this big aluminum cauldron Mom had in bee soup. And I love that vegetable soup. She really make it up there. And of course, she'd make all this pastry. And Kringlas all the time. We had to. It's cheaper than going out and buying it. She'd make delicious whole wheat bread. Oh, that smelled good. But when she made it, she'd make a dozen loaves, you know. I don't know how many. And rolls and all that sort of thing, because she had to keep the family going on nothing. Mm-hmm. And Dad was doing the best he can. One thing he did, he collected the rent on the other two apartments, and he never paid taxes or interest on his house. Mm-hmm. But no one would foreclose a house because their houses all over the country were foreclosed.
Yeah.
So he thought, well, he had to live on it. So then he had toolboxes in several factories. Realized that he had made a lot of friends since he owned a big factory himself that he lost because of depression. So these friends would give him a call, and maybe they have a week of work or 3 days of work or 3 weeks of work. So if he didn't work at one place, he had another place. But as long as they had a toolbox there, they realized that he's still employed by them. So,
oh, yeah.
So he had a lot of companies and friends that were calling him in.
That was pretty smart.
Yeah, and if he had worked one day in one place, well, then he'd say, well, I can come in this in the evening. Okay, John. And then he started selling Frigidaire refrigerators. Imagine selling refrigerators in the Depression.
Yeah.
And the way he did that, he had worked as his contractor in building some apartment buildings. Not a lot of them, but some. And so he learned to know contractors and builders and bricklayers, and a lot of these people he knew owned buildings, apartment buildings. So he went around to all of these guys he knew, their friends, and said, now listen, I know that you're going to have to replace the refrigerator sometime, somewhere. Maybe a guy owned a 12-apartment building or something. You know. And he said, I'll give you a better buy on a refrigerator than anybody else. He said, but I can't keep chasing after you. I don't have time. Mm-hmm. So they would, he'd say, you call me, and I'll give you a better buy than anybody. So it turned out that he was working out of a little store that sold just Frigidaire refrigerators. And there are several salesmen that had been selling Frigidaires for years. He came out with the top sales. And he wasn't even a salesman. They could never figure out how he did that, and he never told them. That was his secret. They'd do the same thing. And that didn't mean he sold a lot of refrigerators, but with some extra cash. Because things just weren't selling.
Yeah.
So they had to be very careful. But as a little kid, I probably had as much stress as anybody else, and the problem is I didn't understand the stress. And my grades in school weren't doing well, and I had a teacher that was grumpy. She's a friend of the family, Esther Nelson.
Yeah, I remember you telling me.
Yeah. And she was on my case. I don't think I was a bad kid. I don't think I misbehaved. Mm-hmm. But I was absent a lot. You know, I was sickly. I missed one whole year of school for illness, or nearly a year. And I remember they used to give little cardboard cutouts of dogs and donkeys, and you take a spool, empty thread spool, mm-hmm. and a lot of people did their own sewing in those days. So you take a empty spool and you put the tail of a dog on one side, the rear end, and the front end on the other side, and you glue it on. Mm-hmm. And if a kid was in school all week, they get a cardboard. And I wanted to get those cardboards so badly, but I never got one. Which meant that I never was in school that whole year, any time, a complete day. And I think that was the year where I missed some months of school. And I don't know what was really wrong with me. They couldn't figure it out. They They said I had a mastoid infection, and those days they would cut out the mastoid bone in the back of your ear, but they never had to go that far with me. So I guess, suppose it was a childhood disease that I had or something, or maybe it was just the stress of the home.
Yeah.
So then we moved up to Ludington, Michigan, and Al and Hazel got their own apartment. He was getting paid then, and we got away from a lot of the stress. Grandmother went to live with, I guess, Aunt Almeda or somebody. A lot of the stress was gone, and after we were in Ludington, Michigan a few weeks, Mom checked with the teacher, wanted to know if I was going to pass. It was getting near the end of the year, and or maybe right at the end of the year, I don't remember. And they said, by pass, sure, he's doing fine. He doesn't have any problems. So if I was having problems in Chicago, it was probably due to stress.
Yeah.
But once we moved to Michigan, I was getting along fine. And I was able to roam through the woods and the fields up in Michigan, and I loved it up there. It was very nice.
Yeah.
It wasn't the hustle and the bustle of Chicago. And well, that's something about our food.
At Christmas time, did you have Swedish Christmas decorations there?
Not like your mother does.
Now, what would you do special at Christmas time?
It was all built around the church. Church had all kinds of Christmas festivities, which were largely Swedish tradition. Of course, in those days, I didn't know any more than it was American tradition.
Mm-hmm.
They'd have a lot of dinners and coffees and refreshments and skits and plays and your Sunday school program where everyone would say his piece. I remember the first time in our big Chicago church, it was like a big barn. It was a nice old church with nice woodworking and trim. But the first time I had to give a piece, my speech, I got up in front and I froze. I just stood there and I couldn't utter the word. Everyone was coaching me. And I was way down in the lower beginner's department or something. I remember because I was so embarrassed I couldn't remember a word of my piece. And they're all very kind, nice people. Friends of the family for a couple generations, you know. Everyone knew everybody, although it was a big church. And my grandfather and father had been deacons, and you know, so we were really into things. Yeah. I miss it. Miss the church. Miss the people. I still write to a lot of them. My age.
What did you do at home? Anything different at Christmas time?
Well, we didn't have Lucias and things like that. We would just have a Santa Claus and give out presents and eat and. Pretty much American, but it was on Christmas Eve. It was almost Christmas Eve. Always Christmas Eve.
Okay. Maybe we should go to the post office now.
Yeah. Later on, and when we moved to Ludington, I know I had to give a piece at Christmas, and I have quite a long thing to recite, and I did fine. And in fact, there's a kid next to me had forgotten his lines, and I helped him through his lines. So I grew up a little bit. Okay, we're going to go. Let me address this.
This is December 29th, 1987. And this will be notes on John T. Holmquist.
We were riding in the car this morning, and I remembered some things about John T. Holmquist, dad and grandfather. He was a rather quiet person with a good sense of humor, but it was sort of a subtle sense of humor, and he would love to laugh at his jokes. But when he tried to pull a fast one on someone to crack some practical joke, he'd break out into a grin and always give himself away, so you knew that something was coming. He was not a person to talk very much, and he wouldn't get up and lead as a cheerleader or try to inspire anyone with his conversation. But he always had something worthwhile to say, and people seemed to respect what he said. The thing that I mentioned this morning was that he visited us while I was in seminary in Bethel, probably about 1953. And he mentioned that he was sponsor of the Senior Young People Society in the, what was known then as the Emerald Avenue Baptist Church in Chicago, now the Salem Baptist Church. Same church that our family's gone to for about four generations now, maybe five generations if you speak of Joan Brown, my niece. At any rate, this was a large Senior Young People Society, and he was the one that was the connection between the Young People Society and the Board of Deacons. The Board of Deacons ran the church, and it carried quite a bit of authority, but he was a gentle, kind person. He loved kids, and they liked him. So he became sort of a counselor and an advisor and a mentor to these kids. He just mentioned it, and I, at the time, and I never looked into it at all. I was busy going to school, but about 6 months ago, I talked to Don and Millie Nordstrom, who were in that age group about that time. Don had been in my Sunday school class when he was in junior high, and I was probably senior high, or maybe I was just out of high school.
And they lived here in Ventura?
They lived in Westlake Village then, and they still live, now they live now in San Diego. And Don Nordstrom made mention to the fact that the dad was the sponsor of the young people and how much they enjoyed him. He was certainly a father figure, and they could confide in him, and he's a very loving person. And it seemed almost that the dad was out of character because he wasn't one who did a lot of talking, but yet apparently he fit in very well in the youth work there. So what am I going to be talking about?
This is Notes on Mei Lin.
Oh, okay.
A few of the cute things about Mei Lin when she was a little girl.
I kind of wish we could list these things.
These are notes on Bernard Holmquist's Navy experiences. Perhaps you can start off when saying when you got into the Navy and the time when you got out, and then just tell us some of the things that went on while you were there, what you were doing, mm-hmm. some of the interesting things that happened to you.
You have my serial numbers and things like that?
Yeah, I have serial number.
All right. I haven't given this any thought, so it's not organized. I should have taken a piece of paper and written down some things in sequence.
That's okay. I'll get it on paper, and then we can go over it and reorganize it later.
I went into the Navy in the spring of 1957. I really wanted to get in Christian work, but I really didn't know where to go. I was interested in the service, but I didn't know what service to get into. But Mom liked the Navy, and she liked ships, and I suppose that influenced me more than anything else. I might say, overall view, the Navy treated me very well. I felt at the time that the Lord led into the Navy, and it seemed that everything I touched turned to gold. I thought the Lord blessed me in the years I was in the Navy, and I went to the recruiter, just plain old recruiting station, North Hollywood, and got some papers and filled it out, and they mailed it in, and I got word from the Navy to go down for an interview at the Navy base forget what naval district that is anymore, 5th, 12th, or whatever it is, in San Diego. And I was interviewed by an old Navy chaplain. I think he was really retired, and I didn't realize at the time, but he was an admiral. And we hit it off, and I think he gave me a good recommendation, because everything went smoothly from there on in. This was prior to this was probably early spring or sometime after Christmas. I don't remember the date. So then I was, the Navy was after me to turn in my ordination papers, but I couldn't because I hadn't been ordained, but they didn't know that. But I had made plans for ordination, just ready, I had to wait for them to go through all the technicalities of that. I don't know, should I say anything about my ordination?
Yeah, go ahead.
I don't even have the date here. You can look on my ordination papers.
Yes, sir.
I was questioned by some of the pastors who had the job of selecting candidates for ordination of the Conservative Baptist Association of Southern California. It's a pretty strict group. They're very careful on doctrine and just a lot of things, on training and so on. And they thought that I was a good candidate for ordination. So then I had to appear before an official consul at the Fountain Avenue Baptist Church in Los Angeles, which was a large conservative Baptist church. And one thing in my favor, an old friend of the family, Reverend Cedric Peterson, Cedric Peterson, was a pastor there. And my parents and Cedric Peterson's parents were old-time friends from my church in Chicago. His father's name was Ivor Peterson, and he was a Swedish Baptist pastor. They're old friends. And I guess Cedric Peterson kind of helped me along, because I was not a member of I was not raised in a conservative Baptist church.
How do you spell Cedric?
C-E-D-R-I-C. However, at that time I was helping out the pastor, sort of assistant pastor of the Laurel Heights Baptist Church in Pacoima, California. The pastor had a heart attack, so I was kind of acting as pastor. In fact, they made me assistant pastor, but it didn't last very long because I went into the Navy. And when he couldn't preach, I would preach. The church is no longer there. It became a car wash. They tore it down and put a car wash in there. And the congregation was small and couldn't afford to build another church. So I'm kind of skipping around because I haven't planned this out at all.
That's fine, because we'll reorganize it.
Okay.
Paper.
So I appeared before the ordination council at the Fountain Avenue Baptist Church, and they quizzed me. And this was the same day as they had a conference of the churches in Southern California. So the church, this big church, was packed with delegates. Delegates were, I think, the pastors of each of the many conservative Baptist churches in Southern California, and then two members from each of the church. So I stood up in front, and they fired questions at me for about an hour. And they're really picky. They're nice, they're polite, but they're picky. But you realize that I came from the Swedish Baptist. I was not one of them, so they had to be careful. The only question that caused them problems was when they asked me if I were in a position to recommend a pastor or a candidate for ordination, and he was not a premillennialist. In other words, he's a post or amillennialist. Would I recommend him for ordination? And I said, other factors being the same, if he were an amillennialist, I would still recommend him for ordination. I'm not sure whether I would take that position anymore, for various reasons, but nevertheless, that was my position
then. You would recommend
him? I would, yeah, I would recommend him, even if he were an amillennialist. I would have to think that through again if I would have the same answer. And a couple of the pastors felt that no one should be a member, a pastor in the Conservative Baptist unless they were premillennialists. I think they have loosened up on that now. I don't think they would. So they started talking among themselves how many of them were amillennialists, and they discovered that a few of their own members were amillennialists. So that was the only obstacle in my way, that I was honest with him. I told him I was premillennialist myself. You often get a tooth feisty or something.
Look at it.
Trying to get down a piece of fruitcake here. Well, at any rate, I had to go in the back room. There are a couple other guys that were examined too the same day. And so imagine the amount of time they spent just examining candidates. But I guess they questioned me the longest because I, I came from the outside. So they recommended me for ordination anyway. Then they had to send a delegate to the actual ordination service, which was a short time later. Perhaps a month later, I don't remember. And that was held at the Laurel Heights Baptist Church in Pacoima, where I was helping out as an assistant pastor. That was a big gathering. It was a little church, but it was packed in. And people I knew, friends. I was working at Bendix at the time too as a machinist. So quite a few of my fellow workers were there. And different individuals, I don't remember what was on the program. There is a program someplace around, you probably have it. One person came was an Army chaplain, Franklin Douglas, who's a dear friend of mine. Yet he's totally blind now. He was an attorney who decided to go into ministry, and I met him at Conservative Baptist Seminary in Denver the year I was there. And I always call him Doug.
Was I there at your ordination?
Yeah, you must have been there, because my family was all there. Mm-hmm. Now you would have been there. In fact, I would have insisted on it. I think I did, as I remember. So both you and May Lynn. Can't remember if Terry was around then or not. yeah, he had to be. Yeah. So it was a nice service. If I had the program, I could expand on it some more. And they had to have someone recommend me from the Conservative Baptist Association of Southern California, and different pastors did different things like they do at ordinations. And then I said a few words at the end and invite everyone to stay for refreshments. Well, that qualified me to finish my papers for the Navy. I sent it in and got my orders, and my orders were to chaplain school at Newport, Rhode Island. Very interesting historic spot, not only for the Navy, but for the nation too. And Newport has a lot of the old homes, and the Kennedy family has a lot of ties there. And I think JFK was actually married in Newport, and I paid a visit to the big Catholic church there and talked to the priest, and I can't remember, I think he was involved in Kennedy's marriage. The reason I paid a visit to him was that there was a relative of his in Los Angeles that I knew, and said, when you get to Newport, please look up my brother or whatever it was. So long ago, I've forgotten, can't even remember his name anymore. And he told me a little bit about the Kennedy wedding and that sort of thing. I may give him things that are historically incorrect, but that's as I recall them.
Yeah.
At any rate, I don't even remember the length of chaplain school anymore, but if you would look at my orders, which are packed away someplace, you'd be able to figure that out.
What things did you take at chaplain school as subjects?
We didn't get into theology at all in chaplain school. They were practical things. In counseling, how to deal with sailors. We made many trips aboard other naval installations. Just a lot of practical Navy things, nothing theology at all. But every morning we had to take turns giving devotions in the mornings, and I was, of course, scared to death to speak in front of the head of chaplain school. His name was Captain Butler, I think. Very fine gentleman. I liked him very, very much. And also the other chaplains. We were already commissioned as lieutenant, as junior grades. It wasn't a thing that we could flunk or fail. We were already commissioned. And we had our new stiff uniforms on and so on. And they teach us how to salute and how to march. Of course, I was an ex-Marine. I knew how to march. And fire control, if we had to be a fire aboard a ship, we might have to pitch in to help put out the fire. How to swim through water that had oil and fuel burning. And all kinds of practical Navy things. And we visit the submarine base at New London. No, that was, I guess that's New London, Connecticut, the sub base. Spent a day there. Went to the Coast Guard Academy, spent a day there. Then we get weekend assignment. Oh, I was telling you about devotions. So whenever I had my term for devotions, I would use a little devotional booklet, Daily Bread. But I took some old Daily Breads along, so if anyone else read Daily Bread, they wouldn't recognize it. It had good illustrations, and it's easy to make an outline for a little devotional out of Daily Bread. So I became known as a very good speaker. But actually, I just get my little devotionals out of Daily Bread. So I got some rather important assignments on Sunday, speaking assignments. On the Easter Sunday, for instance, I was sent to the Naval Hospital. Where in the world was it? No, it's in my record someplace. I even got a slide of it. Big Naval Hospital, and I was speaking at the chapel, and so it was quite an honor to get a speaking engagement where I had the high-ranking medical officers and the interesting part of it was that the chaplain there was Episcopal. So I conducted a high Episcopal service. I don't know how high, but I went and visited the chaplain, and he was very congenial, and he showed me where to bow and where to do this, that, and the other thing. And I practiced it, and Easter came, and I went through it just fine. And I had an Easter sermon that I had written when I was in college. Actually, I wrote it for the Swedish Baptist General Conference newspaper, the Baptist Standard, and it was published on an Easter when I was at Wheaton. So I took that and memorized it over again, and use that as my sermon, and it turned out real well, and I got a good rating from everyone on that. And so we finally graduated chaplain school. I can't think of anything too significant. All the guys, the other young chaplains, they were all real nice fellows, and we got along well. And
how many others were there?
I can't remember how many, maybe a dozen.
Just in your class or in the whole school?
Well, this was really a Navy graduate school. They send naval officers, high-ranking naval officers there, probably, I don't know, commanders and above, for graduate work in various areas, not necessarily just naval science, but it could be in, I think, I'm not sure, but I think in physics and just about anything. So the chaplain school was just a little part of this old Navy base. Newport is an interesting old town. And we drove along the beach to see these great old houses that were owned by millionaires, but not even, no one lived in, but they would keep them up. They'd have caretakers in a perfect position, condition, but no one would actually be living in them, probably hadn't been living in them for 50 years. But they still maintained them. Also saw a stone structure that was supposed to have been built by the Vikings maybe 1,000 years ago. And it was right in the middle of this area of all these big old mansions. There's a lot of tall grass around them, but it was maintained pretty good. That was kind of interesting because I didn't even know anything like that existed. Hope I'm not getting too far afield on this.
Sidelights are interesting.
Okay. So I went home. I got orders. My first orders were to report to Naval Training Center in San Diego. So I went home on leave and Mom was Mom and I had to try to find housing, and we went down to San Diego and they said no housing was available, but then all of a sudden they had an opening right there, Navy housing. Can't remember the name of the housing now. Must be in the record someplace. And they said, well, if you take this housing, you can have it. Otherwise, we have to start calling people. The people on the list, it was a long list. I said, I'd take it. So we took it without even looking at it. So we had to rent our house in Granada Hills, California, and move the family to San Diego. Of course, the Navy moved us. We didn't have that much furniture in those days, so it didn't cost the Navy too much. Navy housing was sparse, but wasn't anything luxurious, but it was certainly adequate. And we were able to use the commissary and the PX. It was all a new experience for the family. And there was a place between buildings where I could play ball with Len and Carrie and May Lynn too. And Len would, and Carrie would go walking up and down the hills and down into the valleys and see the old ranches, and they felt they were in the old Wild West, and they kind of enjoyed that. I don't know if you remember that, do you, Len? Yeah. A lot of activities on the Navy base. They all got in swimming classes, and they're taught swimming by professional Navy teachers. Big pool, Olympic-sized pool. Always things for the kids to do, and of course we had a lot of official functions we had to attend. And there, when there's a Navy party, you don't have a choice. You're invited. You go. It's a It's like an order. And we met a lot of nice people. Well, the 4th of July celebrations were something that you wouldn't believe. They would take the profits from the PX over the year and just feed you more food than you can possibly eat, even if you took just a little bit of everything. And fireworks and official entertainment, like Hilo Hattie from Hawaii, who's very famous Hawaiian dancer, she could participate, and they had a lot of games for the kids, and of course the fireworks and everything else was a, so it was a nice experience. But while we're there, we decided to buy a house, and I think the house is on Providence Road. It was just a little two-bedroom house and one bath, but it was a nice little house, yellow. Mom planted flowers around, surprised to see that they grew. She grew some nice carnations. I would have to speak every Sunday before the recruits. I was in recruit training to begin with. And we may have, as I recall, maybe 2,000-3,000 recruits in front of you, and they had to attend church, Navy recruits. They're in boot camp. So that was an experience to preach before large crowds, and I felt I did all right, and better than I expected I would do. And then Sunday nights, they asked me to have charge of South Chapel, which is a voluntary service, and that's where South Chapel held a couple hundred people. So I would have an evangelistic service there. And I'd often have outside speakers and always have outside music, young people that would come in from the churches and sing. And then the young people would mix with the sailors afterward. And these were recruits, you understand, and they didn't have any contacts with civilians for weeks and weeks. And these civilians included pretty civilian girls from the churches, which was nice for everyone concerned. Of course, they couldn't leave the base, so there's no dating or anything. The Navigators, I contacted the Navigators, a Christian group, and they came out every Sunday night. And when we'd give an invitation, they would take care of the sailors, talk to the sailors that would come forward to make commitments of one kind or another to the Lord. So, and then also the Navigators would follow up. They would write the sailors and keep track of them where, as long as they're in the Navy, the best they could, and let them know about other Navigator homes all over the world.
Great.
So it was a good opportunity. I also taught a small Bible class of officers, and we were just studying the Book of John. And we probably had a half a dozen that would come out. That met once a week. We had to give character guidance lectures. That was a big thing. And we had a certain prescribed lectures we had given on different ethical and moral subjects. And these lectures were organized and structured where we had flannel graphs that were made for us and so on. So we had to cover certain areas, but then we had the ability to use our own illustrations and our own personalities in presenting these structures. It's nothing we memorize as long as we covered the area. And this covered a good part of our day. We have to give, I don't recall, maybe 3-4 lectures a day, and that was very tiring. So we worked hard. And we had time, certain amount of time for counseling sailors. And these were all boots, recruits. And they divided up the the chaplains according to the number of sailors in each denomination. When the sailors come in, they'd say, they'd ask them what their denominational preference was, and the Catholics would go to the Catholics, the Methodists go to the Methodist chaplains, and since I was a Baptist, I'd have a proportion of the Baptist recruits. And there were other Baptist chaplains too. They would have others. But every recruit was allowed 15 minutes with a chaplain. And this took a lot of time. But it was a great opportunity to talk to these sailors.
They had 15 minutes if they wanted it.
If they wanted it. Yeah, it wasn't compulsory. They didn't have to sit there and listen to you. But they all had to come in and talk to you, as I remember. But they didn't have to stay. Most of them did, because they've been in boot camp, isolated, and they like to talk to someone, and sometimes they had problems.
Like what?
Oh, they get homesick. Some want to get out of the Navy. A lot of interesting things. One sailor came one day and he said a lot of stories. He said that when he joined the Navy, the recruiter said he never had to go to sea. And he said now he finds that after boot camp, he's going to be assigned to a ship. And he said he didn't want to go to sea. He doesn't like the water. And so he wanted to get out of the Navy. And there are things like that. And the recruiters sometimes would tell the sailors just anything, just to get them to sign on the dotted line and join the Navy. One sailor came to me, and he was still in civvies, and he wasn't even supposed to be over by our offices. He was supposed to be in the recruit section, and how he got past the guard, I don't know, but there he was in civvies. The next day they were going to give him his Navy haircut and everything else and uniforms. And at any rate, he was concerned because his wife and I think it was three or four children were coming in the bus station. And he'd been promised a Navy housing for them while he's in boot camp. And this is ridiculous. And at that time, they were not even recruiting civilians who had children. So we had to take care of the course of dependents coming in. So I dispatched an officer to meet him and got him housing for a couple of days in a Quonset hut house that was available for guests, and reported to the commanding officer of the base, whose name was Captain Dornan then. And a couple days later, this sailor was out of the Navy, the shortest tour of duty probably anyone in the Navy. And then I got a note from Captain Dornan in a week or so saying that the recruiter who was up in San Francisco is no longer recruiting. a lot of humorous things.
Do you remember another story?
Yeah. I just thought of one. Got a call. We'd have to have night duty periodically. We'd be on all night. Now, about 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock at night, we'd go home, and any emergency calls comes in at the whole base. They direct them, that is pertaining to the chaplain, they direct it to our home. So you may have to get on your clothes in the middle of the night and go back to the base. Well, this particular night, I got a call that a sailor was messing around in one of the barracks, and he went through a window and cut his leg, and they had to sew him up. They had stopped the bleeding, but they had to sew him up. But he was Christian Science, and he wouldn't accept any medical attention. So the doctors were frantic. They didn't know what to do. They were afraid that he would start bleeding again. So all I did was call the Christian Science Reader. I knew who he was, and I had his phone number. And then I had him call the dispensary, and the kid was not in the hospital. The sailor wasn't in the hospital, but he's in the dispensary, and the doctor was there, and he talked to the young man, the sailor, and said, well, he said, you did right by not accepting medical attention, but there's one rule that supersedes that, and that is you have to accept orders. And he said, now if the doctor orders you to have your leg sutured, well, then you're going to have it sutured. Of course, the Christian Science Reader knew he had to do it, but he just had to get around them, the rules. And just a kid, he was just trying to be conscientious and do everything right. And but, oh, I guess there are a lot of stories that you don't remember. Another job I was given, I became choir officer, which meant I was in charge of everything musical in recruit training. And we had a number of pianos and organs and things like that, and I had to make sure that they were kept clean, and I didn't do it myself, but that they followed the rules, only certain people could play them, and they were having trouble with people breaking the rules. So I did the simple thing. I listed all the rules I could think of, and after talking to the former choir officer and different things, and I had them all typed down, and I scotch taped them to the side of each piano and each organ, and these were orders, you know. So after that, there's no more problem. Mm-hmm. And so a choir officer also meant that I was in charge of the recruit choir, which was quite a famous choir. And we had a professional choir director, but I was officially in charge of the men, and making sure that transportation was provided and food was provided and things like that when we went out to sing. And they'd sing all kinds of songs that men would sing, and also some religious songs. They'd always sing Eternal Father, which is very impressive. The Navy loves it. The Navy, official Navy,
didn't
him.
We have a record of theirs?
Yeah, we have a record of that. At any rate, Bill Huffman, a good friend of mine, Nazarene chaplain, was choir officer before me, so he helped me get started. And because he was a good choir officer, I got off to a good start, and I made an impression. I made a good impression with the commanding officer, that is the head chaplain. Our choir really sang a lot of important functions in San Diego. And once we appeared on television, I was interviewed on television because I was a choir officer. I was scared silly. you had to be real, your uniform and everything had to be in real good shape, and you had to look good because you're representing the Navy. And that was very, very important. As choir officer, I was also representing Captain Dornan, the commanding officer. And D-O-R-N-O-N, I think. And so he would give me some other assignments too. That was sort of military and yet of a spiritual significance. And I was rubbing shoulders with pretty important people. It's just a little old JG, Lieutenant JG that I was. JG means junior grade. But my immediate boss was Chaplain Hohenstein. Great man. I don't know, H-O-H-E-N-S-T-E-I-N. Raymond Hohenstein. He was the first chaplain of any service to be wounded in World War II. And the Chaplain Corps history of the Navy has a page or two just written on his experiences. A great man. He's Missouri Synod, a very godly man. Except he liked to smoke his pipe. I don't know if they let him into heaven on that one or not.
They might have a pipe waiting for him.
They might have a pipe waiting for him. And he was very kind, and his wife. Um, I'm kind of skipping around. I want to mention Mom. She was a tremendous support for me because she mixed so well with the Navy wives, that is, the chaplain wives. When later on, when we're on destroyers, she mixed with the Navy wives and San Diego's chaplain wives. And she became vice president of the Chaplain Wives Association. And there was an article written in the San Diego paper about her and her experiences and background, born in China, and quite a big article.
What the year was that?
57, 58. 1957, 1958. And she was very charming, excellent, did a good job. And she certainly didn't hurt my career one bit. And they went on the Kearsarge. She still speaks about that, a big aircraft carrier, spent a day there with chaplain wives. She tremendously enjoyed all the social activities. Now, there are a lot of chaplains in San Diego. I don't know how many. There are about 900 chaplains in the Navy at the time, and probably 200 of them were in San Diego. I don't know if that's correct, but maybe 150, maybe 200. Because there are a lot of naval installations, North Island and 32nd Street Base and Miramar Air Force Base, and there was a Naval Training Center, had the boot camp, and then they had the advanced training. Later I was transferred into the advanced training section of the training center for